In The Day and Somnus, Aristotle says that some people have dreams in which they seem to be arranging the objects before them in accordance with their mnemonic system. And then Francis Yates says, rather a warning, one would think, against doing too much artificial memory, though this is not how he is using the illusion. And in fact, Dame Frances misunderstands here. She's obviously never had this experience herself, and so she's writing as in this stage just as an academic. What Aristotle is saying here is a primordial. Perhaps some of you have had that particular dream of arranging. I speak from my experiences for a second so you can follow this. In a dream, there was a woman in kind of like a khaki shirt and khaki trousers standing in front of an enormously long table, which was filled with broken electronic junk. The spirals of the wires and the cacophony of the cracked dials and the whole thing littered this entire table maybe 100 feet long, like a picnic table, 100 feet long, enormous size. And she was patiently trying to sort this out. And in the dream, there was no way that I could see her face. No way that I could come to see who this was. This is a dream after a complete smash of the ego. That figure there is that's the anima. That's the soul patiently putting it back, putting the circuitry back together. And one in that condition, where one only sees that the table is littered with the ruins of it, cannot behold the face of the soul. So that figure here that Aristotle is talking about in De Insomnis, that some people have dreams in which they seem to be arranging the objects before them in accordance with the mnemonic system, is the very symbolic image of presenting your inner soul, bringing back the communicative and technical expression of the deep self, restoring it. And this is a sight. And Dame Frances apparently never had this. But she's good enough. She writes further, and in the De Anima, that's on the soul, anima is Greek for soul, there is a similar phrase, it is possible to put things before our eyes just as those do who invent mnemonics and construct images. To a Greek, it would be putting it before the inner eye. Or to an ancient India, that would be putting it before one's inner ear. And there are many other senses. For instance, in Asian thought, consciousness is a sixth sense. It's a part of the sense apparatus, like the eye, the ear, the mind is a sixth sense. So that there are whole metaphors based upon consciousness of consciousness, the mind of the mind. Zen is like that. So that when one reads like in high Japanese civilized spiritual talk, like in Dogen in the 13th century, he talks about how the mind of the mind gives the Dharma, that one has to go within that, and that until one can do that, the mind that you were using has only had an approximation of the moon, just a hazy moon at best. You thought it was clear, you thought it was the moon, but in actual fact, it's just a hazy moon. but in the mind of the mind is the real moon. And it's not a finger pointing at the moon that is the mistake. Mistaking the finger pointing at it for the moon. It's that the whole entourage of the pointing at the moon in the first place, that whole entourage of activities was an illusion. If you want to think moon, you can, with a clear mind, think moon. You don't have to point at any image of it. The real moon is there. So that the Zen phrase, that enlightenment is like seeing the full moon with the clouds dispersing, is not a metaphorical, literary illusion at all. It's that those clouds reveal that moon now, and one sees that with the mind of the mind. The Shobo Genzo by Dogen is a classic statement of that in Japanese civilization. The eye of consciousness, sometimes it's called. So there are different ways of doing this. But Dame Frances goes on, this is important here. But the most important of the four illusions, and the one which most influenced the later history of the art of memory, comes in a book, De Memoria et Reminiscentia, on memory and remembrance. The great scholastics, Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas, with their proverbially acute minds, perceived that the philosopher, in his De Memoria et Reminiscentia, refers to an art of memory which is the same as that which Tullius teaches in his second rhetoric, Tullius being Tullius Cicero. So that Cicero's art of memory is the same as Aristotle's art of memory. And Albertus Magnus and Aquinas are the first ones to put that together and to realize this is one tradition. It isn't that the Greeks had this way and the Romans had this way and maybe others had different ways. This is all one tradition. And I think you should know here that Aquinas was very young and Albertus Magnus was very old. So it was almost like a grandfather and a grandson relationship. It wasn't like father and son, but like grandfather and grandson. And both of them had such tremendously accurate minds, ordered, that they could see that this was all one tradition. It's the first time for 1,000 years that anybody realized that there was, in fact, an esoteric tradition that went all the way through, and that they, 1,000 years later, inherited that tradition, but that there had been a gap. And they restart the tradition. They restart it in the 13th century. So that Aristotle's work, because it was seen to be before Cicero's, 300 years before Cicero. So Aristotle's work thus became for them a kind of memory treatise to be conflated with the rules of Cicero, and which provided philosophical and psychological justification for those rules. Aristotle's theory of memory and reminiscence is based on the theory of knowledge which he expounds in his De Anima. The perceptions brought in by the five senses are first treated or worked upon by the faculty of imagination. Notice that imagination, in terms of coherent understanding, precedes memory. So that imagination is what we would call perceptual cognition. And memory is recognition, and always has a conceptual tinge to it. So that consciousness, in its thinking mode, always has an ideational tone to it and a recognitional quality. There's a tone of certainty to consciousness which is not there in imagination. Imagination by itself, rather like on the dream level, is a feeling-toned, affective activity, and its characteristic is ambivalence. Not ambiguity, but ambivalence. So it's like the dream world. And the mythological horizon, mythological language, is correct when it's ambivalent. But thought is correct when it is certain, when it's exacting. That it doesn't get rid of the ambivalence, but it resolves the ambivalence into a higher unity. The term for that in ancient times was synthesis. And the correct usage of it is used by Hegel, and Hegel's term when he talks about synthesis. The correct movement of thought is to achieve a higher synthesis. And the process is to achieve higher syntheses. But notice that it's easy to mistake that kind of language for thinking, well, thought then is synthetic. Thought is a paltry imitation of the world. That fundamental error, that fundamental misunderstanding ruined the 19th century consciousness, almost ruined it. I can't tell you how tragic it was, except that it got us to our century in which we have been trying to live out and sort out the ignorance of the 19th century with both hands and both feet, and we've just barely been able to bail ourselves even. Thought is not a synthetic imitation of the world. And the inner spirit, the mind of the mind, is not some kind of a fantasy, such as in God is Dead, fantasy. Or that, well, everything is relative, so whatever you get to is just relative, maybe to something else. That is a total misunderstanding. That is really ignorance. That is really sheer ignorance. And we, unfortunately, live at the very tail end of just a hurricane of ignorance like that. And the world, it may seem all right to you, but it's really a junkyard. I've said that many times. It really is. We've got a couple of generations ahead of just sorting things out. So Aristotle's theory of memory and reminiscence is based upon the theory of knowledge which he expounds in his De Anima, on the soul. The perceptions brought in by the five senses are first treated or worked upon by the faculty of imagination. And it is the images so formed. What does the imagination do? It forms images. And it is the images so formed which become the material for the intellectual faculty. How does it become the material for the intellectual faculty? The images formed by the imagination tend to come together. Naively, at first, on the basis of association. All these images of dogs belong together as dog, and one gets the idea of dog. So that ideas are the symbolic focuses for matrices of images. It's like that. But they don't remain there because the symbolic understanding is extremely dynamic and viable. And it doesn't just hold in repository like the imagination holds images in repository. And those images deepen, and that deepening is called the generation of meaning. What is the meaning? The meaning is the proliferation of the associative at first. But one understands then that that associative combination is only a surface phenomenon, that there is a structural, quote, association much deeper, much more profound. So it's based then not on the association, all these things have two ears, therefore they're, and tails, therefore they're dogs. Well, two ears and a tail and other characteristics, it may be cats instead of dogs, et cetera, et cetera. And one gets finer and finer till the ideational capacity. What do we do about your machine? Do you want another tape? Stop talking. Class is over. Yeah, help yourself. Are you able? Is this coming through? Are you able to follow this? I'm trying to disclose to you not only the way in which it actually happened in history, but the way in which it was rediscovered first, rediscovered that it actually happened, and that we today are rediscovering the rediscovery. But that this is not like third hand. It is showing that even in the classical days of Aristotle, it was a rediscovery then. In other words, the tradition is a tradition of rediscovery. Should we turn on the machine? The tradition is a tradition of rediscovery. It's not that like the Renaissance is second hand, and then our age is third hand. It's that these are legitimate way stations along what is really the tradition. The tradition is one of rediscovery all the time. Even as far back as we can go, to the pyramid age of Egypt, it's still a rediscovery then. It never has not been in this form. So that the traditional description is that this that is within had no particular beginning. Or as the Upanishads use the term, is unborn. It never went through a beginning process. That is, in it to itself, it never went through a beginning process, but to us, it is always beginning again. So that the true Genesis point is not the beginning, but in the beginning. It has a gerund, like the Hebrew word Bereshith means in the beginning. Well, anytime you talk about it, it can be a legitimately in the beginning. So that the phrase, which in classical antiquity, which I'm going to use the phrase from that, in Plato's Timaeus, he says very accurately, time is the moving image of eternity. That's the way the Hermetic tradition would say. Time is the moving image of eternity. What is happening here in this world temporally is not untrue. It is extremely truthful. But it is truthful to the fact that it is an illusion. If you could personify this world, and like Odysseus grabbing the old man of the sea, force it to tell the truth, this world, as that person would say, I am an illusion. It would accurately say that to you. I am an illusion. You could believe it. So this world is to be trusted in a kind of an arcane paradoxical way. You can count on this world to be an illusion. It will really be, it will be a great illusion always. You can count on it. So there's a kind of like a spiritual aikido about dealing with the world. It really is illusory, and you can count on it. You can build a geometry on that basis. You can build a higher mathematics on that basis. You can have a an integral and differential calculus, which is exacting to any degree of specificity you want, based on that understanding. And whatever you work out in that calculus will be true in this world, exactly, because of that arcane relationship. And it's not just because Leibniz and Newton first came to that that understanding. The first expressions of calculus as an expressive intellectual form were done in China in the 8th century. Only the Chinese used it as mental training in Taoist monasteries and never thought of applying it. There was no applied higher mathematics in China, although they had developed it in the Tang Dynasty. It's a peculiar quality, then, about dealing with the real. And magic, as traditionally understood, has an integral part with it. We cannot have a fully developed person without bringing this particular subject into the ecology of learning. We cannot have a complete pattern of education without having magic within it. Now you can see, because it's dealing with remembering on the basis of images which are feeling toned, the image base is always the worldly clothing which is architecturally related to your feeling tones. So that when you weed this out, literally when you weed magic out, when the magic goes out of education, the life goes out of the whole process. And it may be quite accurate, but it's cut and dried and doesn't have any effect on the person. You can just think back to yourself. What did you learn in the sixth grade? Can you remember anything exactly? You see? But if you think back to a time when there might have been some incident where you were the life, where the magic was there and cued in, maybe because of a teacher, maybe because of something going on in the classroom, everything is there. You have to put the magic back into education for it to work. And it's not just a metaphor. You have to put the old high magic of the art of memory back into learning. Otherwise, it doesn't have any way to really get into the guts of this world. I have to put it that way. You have to have that. Now, the 19th century inherited from the Enlightenment the idea that ancient magic was old-fashioned. In the Enlightenment, they saw that the traditional expressions of it were no longer the way that it happened, that it had transformed yet again into another phase. And so in the Enlightenment, science was the high magic. But in the 19th century, they forgot that that was the high magic, and they said, well, we're going to have science, we're going to have facts, and we don't want to have anything occult. And you have a peculiar situation. I guess you ever get a chance to get enough bucks to buy my cassettes on the 19th century, there's a progressive dematerialization of the mental perception of the world in the 19th century. So that by the end of the 19th century, almost everywhere that you look, people are haunted by the dematerialization of the world as recorded in their minds. One of the great dramatic images of it is in Heinrich Ibsen's play, When We Dead Awaken. James Joyce described Ibsen's play as some enormous, complicated machine under wraps that we get peeks here and there, but no one knows what it is or what it does. We just know that we're in terrible jeopardy. This quality of bleeding the magic out of life is like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. The very embryo which could develop to become the real person, the very embryo which is the center of the deep self, is by fiat not allowed to participate in the process. And education more and more has become accurately expressive of the junkyard. Do you know that the dropout rate of education in the United States is 50%? The chances of anyone completing the education are dead even, 50-50. You know what that's an indication of? If you have any kind of understanding of probability, you can see that's a total failure. The probability that anyone would come through on just a random thing would be 50-50. It means a total lack. It's indicative of terminal cancer of the society. That society that depends on that form will die. So there has to be a complete redoing, complete, utter redoing. It isn't a matter of adjusting what's there. What's there is gone. But bringing back out again what really is there and what really does work. And the magic is a part of it. This was understood as early as the 12th century, incidentally. She writes, Frances Yates writes, "For the scholastics and for the memory tradition which followed them, there was a point of contact between Memnonic theory and the Aristotelian theory of knowledge, and the importance assigned by both to the imagination. Aristotle's statement that it is impossible to think without a mental picture is constantly brought in to support the use of images in mnemonics. And Aristotle himself uses the images of mnemonics as an illustration of what he is saying about imagination and thought. Thinking, he says, is something which we can do whenever we choose, for it is possible to put things before our eyes just as those do who invent mnemonics and construct images. He is comparing the deliberate selection of mental images about which to think with the deliberate construction in mnemonics of images through which to remember." But this comes to an incredible impasse if there is no recognition that this whole ecology This comes to a complete impasse without a recognition, or even deeper if you want, put it on the deep self level, a realization. The best expression, the one that I used to use 20 years ago, was to show that beautiful engraving that Albrecht Dürer did about 1500 called Melancholia II. And I'll dig it out for you sometime, maybe later today or next week. In Dürer's engraving, all of the wonderful shapes of the intellectual aids of the Renaissance are all arranged there. You have the spheres, and you have the pyramids. You have the magic squares of numbers. You have dozens and dozens of symbolic examples of the paraphernalia of high consciousness. And there is an angel there too. But the angel is seated with a blank stare and his chin on his fist. And he's in deep melancholy because he doesn't know how to use. It's the same image as that dream image that I told you of the woman in the khaki outfit standing before that 100-foot-long picnic table of destroyed electronic gear. If you don't know how to use this, it doesn't do you any good to be in possession of it. It doesn't mean anything to you. Why doesn't it mean anything to you? Because the way by which that meaning could develop involved the use of high magic in its personal expressiveness. And without that, we are fallen angels indeed, sitting in deep melancholy, surrounded by all the divine gifts that there are. And Durer's engraving captures that just poignantly. Durer is a very great artist. He's one who carried on Mantegna. I must tell you this, that Durer's tarot deck is gone. There are a couple of images that survived because they were thought to be engravings, but his tarot deck was destroyed. Why was it destroyed? Because in the Reformation, there were an awful lot of individuals who wanted to efface the Catholic Church from the face of the earth in a very peculiar way. I've talked about this on Tuesday night. That vengeance, that vengeful attitude, especially if carried by a realization of the deep self, has a way of coming back on you. And it did in the case of Durer's tarot deck. It was destroyed. There are just a few images of it that survive. My mind tells me that I should mention to you that Mantegna's tarot deck is related to an architectural expression. He was related to Giovanni Bellini, and it's Bellini who designed the forecourt of St. Peter's in Rome. So that you have Michelangelo's cathedral, but the forecourt and everything is arranged by Bellini, and it's a Memnonic forecourt. That the arrangement of that forecourt in front of St. Peter's is a way of tuning yourself to be able to experience St. Peter's as the divine structure. And I must tell you that this is completely lost in our time. Almost no one knows this. No one uses that. Almost no one goes in and tunes themselves before they go in to the structure. And consequently, if you don't know what you're doing, you don't know where you are, you regress. Instead, the psychic energy is polar like that. Instead of advancing in consciousness, you regress in consciousness. You go back to like being a dull peasant worshiping in some dark age medieval kind of structure, and you fingers crossed, you hope something's going to happen. There's the table with all the junk on it, and your inner soul doesn't know what to do with all of the excellence of the gifts and the proportions and the insight. You're hoping that something will work. See? Terrible. Terrible, terrible situation. The development in the early 12th century, the development of the memory training was the basis of beginning what Dean Francis calls here the scholastics, and everyone calls them the scholastics. Out of this came the kind of logic and logical forms which came to dominate Western thought. Indeed, the computers that are on these desks are instruments of that logical form. They're useful in a very limited sphere, but there are computers that could be designed from a superior consciousness that would perform functions that are real, instead of just these little toy type functions that are given. So that logic is developed out of this in a way. She writes here, and then I'll give you this and then we'll call it for the day. It is a deliberate effort to find one's way among the contents of memory. There's a deliberate effort involved. Our word for it that we started today was dedication. Dedication is when you intend to see it through. It's not willfulness, but it's this kind of dedication. This is what you're going to do. You're going to see this through. So that it is a deliberate effort, and it always is, to find one's way among the contents of memory, hunting among its contents for what one is trying to recollect. 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 Gathering the fragments of the light. In this effort, Aristotle emphasized two principles which are connected with one another. These are the principles of what we call association, though he does not use this word, and of order. Beginning from something similar or contrary or closely connected with what we are seeking, we shall come upon it. Now, I have to give you a little something here. It's not just that you have a thing in its reverse. Because this is a spiritual process, a two-valued logic is a worldly illusion. It's not a two-valued process at all. It's not true or false. It's at least a four-value process. One not only has the thing in its reverse, but you have the thing in its obverse, and then you have the reverse of the obverse, which is really a contrapositive. Now, if you look at very high, sophisticated, medieval logic, even as early as Anselm, Anselm has enough of a mind to realize that in this structure, there's a fifth element, there's a quintessence, which is the pattern of the wholeness which this quaternary structures out. Don't forget that Anselm, who is the father of the scholastics, is the first one to understand that the person of Jesus was feminine. He's the first one to ever use the phrase Mother Jesus in his letters. It takes a tremendous insight to understand that. But that insight only occurs to a highly clear, structured mind. There's a mystery in that. So, Aristotle, beginning from something similar or contrary or closely connected, so that association here is not just a simple thing, but there's a complexity here in association already. Don't think of association as simple. And then there's order. It's like a 1-2. There's association, then there's an order. But the association has its own kind of arcane structure to it. You know, when Jung devised, as a young doctor, the association test, which became like an instrument that made him world famous, the most important thing was not what you had associations for, but Jung was intelligent enough to realize that what was really important was that there were times when you did not have associations. That you have associations just is characteristic. It's like a natural given. But that there should be occurrences where there are no associations, at least immediate, means something's in the way. Something has stopped those associations. What has stopped them? If you get enough of these points where there are no associations, then you can make a negative pattern of what is being interfered with from the normal associative process. The shape of that, he said, that's the feeling tone complex that's getting in the way of you receiving your perceptions and having your associations in a natural way. Well, that feeling tone complex has its own shape. It's an alter ego, in embryo at least, maybe it's developed, an alternative personality. It's actually an alternative persona, mask, to be more precise. But you can see the point here is that the association test is not just that there are associations. Somebody says to Wade Boggs, ball glove, and he thinks of Margot Adams. It's not that at all. It's not what the association is. It's that there is a negative impress, which is more important, that it doesn't happen. So that one not only has the order of the associations, one has the order of the non-associations. The order of the non-associations is important. Yes, the order of the associations is important too, but this other one, like the yin going with the yang, that order of non-associations must be made conscious. How can you make it conscious? You can't make it conscious if you limit consciousness to an associative image base. But memory is extremely powerful, and memory can deal not only with the imagination and an image base, but memory can deal also with a pattern of non-association. It's really very, very powerful. The via negativa, the way of the negative mystics, is extremely logical in this kind of a mode. And one can use it. If one is fully ambidextrous, you can use it just as well as you use the pattern of association. Back to Dame Frances. This passage has been described as the first formulation of the laws of association through similarity, dissimilarity, and contiguity. And you can, we have this book in the library here. In a footnote, she says, see W.D. Ross, Aristotle. That's a 12-volume set published by Oxford. We have the whole set here. And Ross's note on this passage in his edition of the Parva Naturalia. And we have that in one of the volumes there. And you can look up the reference. I've marked this up so when you get a Xerox of it, you'll have the note and everything here. And you can go to the books and find it and read it for yourself. See for yourself. Extremely important point. We can have association through similarity, through dissimilarity, through contiguity, and also that fourth level, that hidden non-association. It's not just a dissimilarity, but there's no association at all. Well, maybe that's also important. Notice here in the high Hermetic tradition, don't throw anything away. Whatever is happening is really valuable. Even if nothing is happening, well, that's really valuable too. So one of the disciplines was always to be alert. The saying I used to use was, be prepared to be prepared. Dame Frances writes, we should also seek to recover an order of events or impressions which will lead us to the object of our search, for the movements of recollection follow the same order as the original events. It's not so much the same order. She misspeaks or miswrites somewhat here. It's a parallel. As one, so the other. So that, for instance, one of the aids to remembering is to get your image impressions right. And one of the geniuses, one of the world-class geniuses of doing this was Claude Monet, the great impressionist. Why was he dealing with impressions so much? Because he's living there at the end of the 19th century, the dematerialization of the world. Getting your impressions straight was extremely accurate. And you know who his guide was, Monet's guide in this? The Japanese artist Hiroshige. Because Hiroshige is a master of the art of memory. I think I've mentioned this before. If you get your eye in, the aesthetic eye of looking at Hiroshige's, and really get it in, you can